Hello, and welcome to Geek Between the Lines, the podcast that explores compelling ideas in some of our favorite geeky properties. I'm Brittany.
And I'm Chris.
And this week we're continuing with our Magician's Watch Through, and we are on Season 4, Episode 5, Escape from the Happy Place. Chris, can you give us a recap of what happens?
Elliot is in his happy place at the physical kid's cottage, unaware that he is being possessed by the monster and is actually within his/the monster's mind. He meets Charlton, a past victim of the monster's possession, and learns that to have control over his body, Elliot must travel to the memory that contains his greatest regret. After exploring a series of traumatic and embarrassing memories, Elliot finally realizes what his greatest regret is, turning down Quentin. In present Fillory, Margot shares the news that Elliot is dead, and the castle mourns while the talking animals lose their voices. Margot retrieves her birthright box, but the lizard inside is unable to share its message. Meanwhile, Iris tasks Julia with trapping the monster by bleeding the poisonous essence from the Black Spire stone, and threatens to kill Julia if she fails. While Q obtains the poison, Julia and Shoshana distract the monster by seeking a translation of his stone in the Breakwheel's library. Alice sends Plover to the poison room, and then reunites with Quentin, who she warns will be killed by the monster when he tries to use the poison. And so instead, Alice obtains the poison a day early, and they create a plan to take down the monster without Q dying. At the moment the plan begins, however, Elliot takes over his body and tells Quentin that he's alive, causing Q to step in front of the poison that Alice throws at Darth Elliot. The monster takes control back and disappears until Iris appears, kills Shoshana, and then is killed by the monster before she can kill Julia for failing.
So many killings.
Yes, and disappearing and appearing.
Attempted killings.
Yes. In fear, Alice crafts a story for the monster that killing Iris was always their plan, and Julia reveals the translation that the stones are pieces of a new body. Also, Penny 23 gets kidnapped.
Penny! I know, Penny was not in this episode much.
No.
Although, who's in it more than Katie was, who's just gone.
Yeah, right?
Poor Katie.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many amazing moments in this episode, so why don't we start with those? What are your magic moments? And don't take all of the good ones.
Yeah, there are definitely a couple great Darth Elliot lines in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Just the, I would like for you to be helpful, Quentin.
Yeah.
It's not only funny, but also just so menacing.
Yeah. But also something that probably Elliot and Margot have thought many times as they're ruling Fillory.
Also true, yes. And then just all of his hatred of books is sad to see, but also very funny.
So funny. Sometimes you can be so boring.
Yeah, I guess hungry for knowledge is not one of the desires that the monster always has.
The monster is not a Ravenclaw.
No. But definitely the majority of the magic moments come within Elliot's mind. There's so many good ones. And yeah, let's just both jump in on these because there's so many.
I mean, obviously with the incessant knocking and Elliot saying, never answer a cop knock.
Yes. Such a good line. It's amazing. And Elliot saying, whoever's that desperate to come in can't be fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, even this, the episode begins with Elliot in his happy place, as we see it being called, dreaming of teaching Todd how to make a cocktail.
Yeah.
Like, that is his happy place.
Elliot, teaching Elliot how to make a cocktail.
Yes, exactly.
But then forcing him to
be
go
Todd.
By his middle name.
Yes. Probably my favorite line is when he finally realizes where he has to go, when he tells Memory Quentin.
Yes.
Lead the creatures to my puberty. Go bravely.
Yes. So good.
It's the most magician's line in the world.
Yeah.
Lead the creatures to my puberty. No other show could possibly have that line make sense.
Go bravely.
Go bravely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and just so many of the things on the blackboard.
Oh, yes.
I mean, obviously, there's some things that are, like, sad.
Yeah, absolutely. But then there's a lot that are, like, multiple haircuts.
Yeah, from the early aughts.
Yes.
It's such a millennial moment that his early 2000s haircuts are deep regrets. dog incident number one and two. Mm-hmm. I just really want to know what they are.
Yeah, we do see failure to rise number one and two.
Just seventh grade.
Yes.
The entire thing.
Similar, break Bill South, in parentheses, all of it.
Yeah. Another one, camping.
Yes, Elliot would not do well in camping.
No. Yeah, I don't even know if he'd do well in glamping.
Yes. I love slacking high school group project. Like the guilt that he feels over that. It's very funny.
At least he feels guilt.
Exactly.
And then a little clip of him saying, "Welcome to the physical kids cottage." And he crosses off, "created a generation of lushes." Mm-hmm.
Yeah, him saying, "Welcome to the physical kids cottage" in front of his bar.
Yeah, I mean, they have a signature cocktail.
Exactly, exactly. Which, again, the episode opened with. Yeah, yeah, and I think it's also great that we see some of the incidents from this show, right? We see his nearly got everyone killed when they were entering Fillory in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. We see him jailing Margot. We see him sleeping with people's boyfriends, including Quentin. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a lot of, I think, great ways of showing that this is not all just character development that happened off screen, but like he is also very much affected by the things that he's done as part of the show.
Exactly. It's not just a moment that he excuses himself from the actions that he's done, which, yeah, is nice to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. But then my last delightful moment in his mindscape is just when the monsters show up in his memory in the high school gym, and the gym teacher comes out and is like, "Hey, you all need to get a visitor's pass from the front office," and gets mauled, and like this is showing that they have a ability to do violence in this place, but just like, you know, they're all frightened by these creatures, and then this awful gym teacher comes in telling them they need visitor passes. I cracked up pretty hard.
Yeah.
What other magic moments did you have though?
I mean, I love how Memory Margot is pulled out of the room by Charlton, and then Elliot runs out after her, and she yells to him, and then you already see she has Charlton in a headlock.
Mm-hmm.
It's just great.
Yeah.
Because even a memory of her is already so capable.
Mm-hmm.
Also, just Charlton, one of my favorite little side people. I mean, he uses the word flummoxed.
All of his language is so good.
So good. I love it. But also how, like, he's practical. Like, he's not petty.
Mm-hmm.
Because Elliot's like, "I'm pretty sure I shot you." No bother. The body was the monster's more than it was mine anyway. Because he doesn't even know how long he's been possessed by it. And he just wants to discuss the TV show Lost. So, yeah, I find him delightful, and him trying to figure out what the word fuck means.
Very good.
Yeah.
It's a chameleon of a word.
Yeah. I just love, "You can't ask the night because she's dead. Dead fuck." It's just so good.
That is very fuck.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Also, quite amusing is, you know, after the whole plan goes awry and all of that, and they're back at the apartment, Julie just walks away from Alice, giving her the finger.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, of anyone to still be mad at her, she gave up her god powers because of what Alice did. And so I like that it's not just like, "Oh, perfect Julia doesn't hold any grudges." Like, no, she's annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
But why don't we go into our next section, which is setting in society. What were you noticing?
Yeah, so one thing is all of the elements of Fillory mourning its king.
I know, they're mourning rituals.
Right? We see the last lay, where the widow lays buried in their loved one's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
the bare-breasted lament, the altar of remembrance,
yeah,
and that the talking sheep are needed to sing the bleats of despair.
Yeah, my favorite. But we need them. Who will sing the bleats of despair?
Yes, exactly.
Just so good.
And it's so funny, and it's like such a perfect place for that Fillory's in now, where like we are so familiar with Fillory that now it can just be like a place for these ridiculous rituals and these one-liners that are just like funny for their absurdity, and having characters like Fen say it with complete sincerity is just hilarious. And yeah, it, you know, obviously there could be some interesting world building involved here, and there's gender roles and all these other things that you can dive into, but at the end of the day, they're also just hilarious.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the sheep sing at funerals, is that because of the rams, or you know, I don't know if there's anything about that, but also just how much clothes Elliot had.
Yes.
That's piled on top of her. It's all great.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, Margo gets to have a kind of micro version of refusing to be objectified, right? Not doing the bare-breasted lament.
Yeah,
you know, not she says she's not going to just cry with her tits out, you know, like that's not the High King that she's going to be, for multiple reasons, but in part because she's not going to do something because tradition tells her that she needs to use her body in a specific way.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also found one line early in the episode really interesting, where Elliot talks about how the things that he loves about Summer most are the nothings of Summer.
Mm-hmm.
Not having responsibilities, not having people around, right? There's nothing that he has to do. And so, like, you know, there's a bit of rest and freedom in that he loves.
I remember loving Summer, too.
Right, exactly. and it's why, one of the reasons I think I've always been a night owl. It's like the introvert in me loves that atmosphere of like people are asleep and I just kind of get to be in my own thing with less responsibilities, less like, you know, immediate responsibilities calling on me. Yeah, I mean, certainly when I was younger, my favorite thing, my favorite time of the year was being out at way past when I should be out as a teenager, like walking around these empty streets in the middle of the summer, just being out in the neighborhood on my own, like in my own head. This is even pre-podcast, Chris, like, you know, so I don't know what I was doing, but I loved it.
Your parents weren't neglectful at all, were they?
Yeah, and so I found this line really interesting, and I wasn't sure if the episode was going to do anything with it. I don't feel like it really did. I think the closest it came to was, you know, because Margo in this memory says that she loves that about him, or that that's something that she admires, and you know, Margo, in a way, kind of has been pushing away her feelings, like almost kind of trying to feel nothing about Elliot in order to get things done. And so I wonder if she can be so overwhelmed by all the things in her life and the responsibilities that she can feel, that that's why she has run away from it from so much of her life. Why her and Elliot were lushes and partiers and all these kinds of things, because future Margot definitely doesn't have any of that and has to kind of force in an emotional nothingness in order to maintain all the other responsibilities that she has.
Yeah, but I don't even know if she was always like that either, even from the beginning, like when they were trying to make the magical gin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's annoyed because Elliot and Mike aren't helping enough,
right?
So she's just like, you just go off, you know, you're just flirting, you're getting in the way, I'm going to get this done, you know? And so I think she's always been one to take charge so that things actually happen. Or when she finds out about the Beast and all of that, she's okay, well, let's make a plan then, even though she wasn't even there for part of that. And she's going to bring the gun and she's going to, you know, I feel like she is always thinking multiple things through and like trying to be prepared for everything.
For sure. Which is why I'm saying I think that I can understand how that's actually restful for her. Like, being able to actually distance yourself from overthinking. And I'm certainly projecting myself onto some of this because, yeah, like, some of that freedom from responsibility comes from my own difficulties with overthinking and overworrying and things like that. I certainly don't rise to the responsibility the way Margot does.
Failure to rise.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's you know, just something that I was thinking about in this episode.
Yeah. I guess more what I mean is that, like, generally there's going to have to be at least one person who's being responsible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just check out, or at least someone is picking up the slack of you doing that, I think, which oftentimes she has in the relationship with her and Elliot.
Totally. The last element of setting in society I had was just the way that Elliot summons the memories of his friends when they're at their most fighty, when they're most, like, able to defend him and powerful in a way. And I think that that's really interesting because in this mind palace, in this mind dimension, Elliot is showing his ability to utilize his thinking to manipulate that dimension, to create that dimension in certain ways, and using that to his advantage. And I think that's a really cool aspect of this kind of environment and the ways of being able to gain advantages in this kind of environment that Elliot, you know, very coolly and capably just figures out on it, you know, very quickly and utilizes. So,
absolutely.
Really, really cool new way of thinking about, you know, magic and the manipulation of the world around you, in this new version, this new kind of mind dimension.
Yeah, it is really interesting because the memories are magic in a way, mm-hmm. and so they can fight these other magic creatures. Yeah, super interesting. Also, not exactly setting in society, but another point on Elliot is just, I appreciate how quickly he is like, oh, okay, this is what's going on. You know, he doesn't have denial about it. Charlton says, close your eyes and imagine that she disappears. And he does it immediately.
I love how Margo's, you know, like, don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he does.
Yeah. So as compared to Josh before, mm-hmm. who had much more denial about the party space he was in, Elliot does not have.
Yeah, good point. What other points did you have for setting in society?
Another thing I was thinking about a lot is just non-traditional relationships and family, because I think that's part of what we have here with Elliot and Quentin in this memory of the conversation or the continuation of what happened at the end of the Mosaic episode from last season, that they're having a conversation. Granted, Elliot's not engaging with it as a real possibility as much as would be good to have the conversation, but there is a little bit of a conversation that happens, mm-hmm. and that Quentin thinks, well, look, proof of concept, why wouldn't we just give this a shot? Why not?
Yeah.
And Elliot says that he's being naive, and that, I mean, he doesn't in these words, but pretty much is like, you're not gay or you're not bi or pan in a way that makes sense long term if you have other options.
Yeah.
And I mean, that can definitely be a fear among people, like with biphobia and stuff like that people can be afraid of being in a relationship with someone who can be attracted to multiple gender expressions and body parts and all of that. But yeah, it's coming from a place of fear rather than just understanding that this person can choose who they want to be with. Just like somebody who maybe is on the extremes of the Kinsey scale could also cheat on you or, you know, whatever. Like, there is no guarantee with that just because they're only attracted to one gender or whatever it is. But it can cause people to question things or whatnot. But then also on the flip side, what Quentin is arguing for is like, well, why don't we try it? You know, maybe it's not what I would have thought for myself, but hey, maybe it works and why not? Something I do appreciate about Quentin is that he isn't rigid in that. Like, mm-hmm. he isn't like, oh no, I'm just straight and I don't know what was going on there, but let's just like forget about it. We can still be friends, right, bro? You know, he's not like that. He's fine with and wanting to explore that possibility, but yeah, things can be complicated, and I appreciate we don't know in terms of the character what exactly Quentin would fall under, if he's like a one on the Kinsey scale, mm-hmm. or if he's a pan-romantic but more heterosexual, or, you know, we're not really sure. But I like that they bring up this kind of thinking about and the kind of negotiations people can make in those spaces of, this isn't just the kind of quote-unquote standard norm sort of relationship, but that doesn't mean it's not worth exploring, even if it would maybe look a little different than a lot of people's relationships look like.
Yeah. Yeah, what a great thing to include in this relationship, and to have it be meaningful for both of those characters, mm-hmm. is, I think, really, really great. It's, I think, great, good representation. It's interesting for these characters. It is compelling. It means that there's stakes to that episode, that it was, you know, we talked a lot about this on that episode of our podcast, about how, you know, oftentimes alternate timelines and things like that can lessen stakes, but because they remember it, mm-hmm. it doesn't do that. And in fact, you know, whether this was the original plan or not, you know, because we didn't see this conversation at the end of that episode. We saw them remember, but then it moved on. Mm-hmm. And who knows if at the time the production team planned on having this be an eventual payoff. But either way, looking at the show as a whole now, we can see that there are real consequences of that event, of the emotional fallout of their relationship and of how they interacted afterwards. And I think that's a really, really strong storytelling. Yeah, it also makes Elliot's revelation that he's still alive that much more powerful, because we saw him referring to this moment that was so important to him and that we see be important to Quentin. And he talks about it. He says peaches and plums. He says mm-hmm. proof of concept. And it really helps us recognize, for Quentin, knowing Elliot is alive changes everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And also gives context and like weight to every time that Quentin uses the word friend for Elliot. Yeah, you can feel like a little bit extra, almost effort or something behind the delivery of the lines, which, yeah, I think is really good.
Yeah, I ship it.
Many people do. But why don't we move into our next section, which is themes and schemes. What were you thinking about for this episode?
Yeah, I think a theme that I'm interested in from this episode is the idea of redemption. You know, this, of course, focuses on Alice's story and mm-hmm. how Plover straight up says that she needs a redemption arc.
Yeah, he announces it.
Yes. And a redemption arc is this thing that gets talked about a lot in stories. You know, certainly on this podcast in the past, we've talked about Zuko and his redemption arc being...
I love it. The best.
Yeah, right. One of the rare examples of one that's done really, really, really well, because so often redemption arcs have a quick ending. They are ended by a major sacrifice or the end of a series or whatever else it might be. And it creates this message that a redemption is kind of a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. You redeem yourself, and then you've claimed redemption. You have been redeemed, and
or even if it doesn't end abruptly, it can just be this upward trajectory that's mm-hmm. just constant. Up and up and up, you know, never exactly. have problems again. Yes. Okay, sorry, again, crazy ex-girlfriend.
Yes. And yeah, I appreciate how Alice this season is attempting redemption in some ways. She says she's trying to clean up her mess, right? Mm-hmm. The mess that she made. She's trying to do what's right in these moments, but she also still has the self-hatred that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. She has the belief that she herself is a monster, and so we don't see her in this episode gain redemption. Mm-hmm. In part because some of the things that she does are themselves questionable. Her sending Plover to the poison room dimension is, you know, her and Quentin talk about this. Does this make her better or worse? Who knows? Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that she's doing from some idea of morality or justice, but is that idea itself skewed or incomplete or, mm-hmm. or you know, otherwise faulty? You know, these are all, I think, great questions, because it's not just that Alice gets a one moment change that means that now she's redeemed, but instead has to continue to try to do what she can to fix what she's caused, but also to live with the repercussions of the choices that she's made and how it's impacted her relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also is a great way to continually show that she is different than season one Alice, because mm-hmm. season one Alice, I think, would have a very strong opinion on if it was right or not. And she's asking because she's not sure anymore. She can't trust herself to make those judgments anymore.
Absolutely. And, you know, she says this semi-facetiously. She says, you know, if Quentin, if you have a recipe for perfect redemption, like, I will hear it. Mm-hmm. You know, understanding that no such thing exists.
Yeah.
But yeah, that highlights how she is not coming in thinking that she knows exactly what to do and how to do it. Mm-hmm. She's open to what people tell her she should do, what they need from her. But Quentin's not at a place where he can give her any of those kinds of answers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I think that that's a really interesting theme, particularly when we see another character in Elliot who is exploring his worst memories, mm-hmm. who's exploring moments of trauma, but also moments of regret, moments of embarrassment, moments of shame and guilt that he has over having sex with people he shouldn't have been having sex with, over, you know, abusing alcohol and substances and having others do the same, of committing violence against even those who he cared about, like his childhood friend. And mm-hmm. Elliot's journey could, and so often is, put forward as its own kind of moral redemption type of journey. When we see characters going through, like, their worst memories and things like that, so often the idea is, and so that they can finally confront their demons and move beyond it. Mm-hmm. And I love that for Elliot, his redemption here is not about a moral choice that he made in the past, but about the fear that he had about being loved and loving someone. Mm-hmm. That for him, you know, whether I think that this is, like, the most moral position one can take, I don't think that that's the case, but that's not who Elliot's always been. Elliot is generally, I think, a person who wants the best for the people around him, but his main concerns are less about, you know, ideas of justice and right and wrong, and more about relational issues. Right? He doesn't want to see people hurt and in pain, starving in fillery or in
even executed.
Exactly, right? Mm-hmm. In those kinds of negative situations. But it's not because of some code that he has or any kind of, you know, moral vision of right and wrong. It's just because
I think it is, but comes out in more relational ways.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And so I love that for him, when it comes to his biggest regret, it is a relational one. It's one where he knows he hurt Quentin, and he regrets saying no out of fear. And that it's his own fear, his own self-destruction that he is regretful of. He's not like Alice, who is on a redemption quest and is exploring these memories and thinking about how he needs to redeem himself. He is someone who is seeing these as other kinds of character failings that he, sure, probably is, you know, is critical of and is regretful of, but it doesn't require redemption because it's not a moral issue for him. And I just think that that's really, yeah, just an interesting kind of take from a show that has a whole episode about a character exploring their past and another character on a redemption arc and those being in conversation with one another, but facing such different kinds of conclusions.
Although, I'm not sure if I agree with the part about him not feeling like he needs the redemption arc because it's not about morality. Because a part of me wonders if he thinks that he can have a redemption arc versus kind of what we were talking about before, like with the theme of being broken or something. Like, he will try to better things for other people, but we don't really see him trying to better things for himself in any way that isn't usually related to escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And that he, as Margot has described it, as low-key always has a death wish.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I wonder if he's just so self-aware that, like, he knows that he can't propel himself through a redemption arc, as well as he knows that he does both good and bad things, and that he's barely holding it together as is. So,
yeah. Yeah, I guess just my reading on him is that the idea of it being tied to redemption doesn't seem to be what his focus is on, what his journey's about.
Yeah.
That he needs to be redeemed from things that he's done. It's, yeah, more complicated and more relational.
Yeah, yeah. As well as, you know, I don't know that he has the self-importance that a character needs to see themselves, it being important for them to have a redemption arc.
That's true.
Yeah. But for someone like Plover, who is in stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, your main characters have an importance because they're the ones you're writing about for whatever reason.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is, I think, one of the great things about that line from Plover, too, is that mm-hmm. as a storyteller, he is familiar with the concept of a redemption arc.
Yeah.
And so for him to say it, I think, is particularly interesting. In the same way that he is trying to go where he's supposed to be, you know?
Yeah.
Which is its own kind of belief in stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what about you? What are your themes and schemes from this episode?
There are two that I was kind of thinking about that kind of correspond to some of what we were just talking about. And one is a quote that does come from Plover in that conversation with Alice as they're like walking to the fountains. He says, "Apologize for what you've done, but not who you are."
Mm.
Because you'll never be able to change that anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that we have that with Alice, obviously. But I think that we have that with Elliot as well, because he tells Charlton that when he killed his bully, that he became the worst person in his own life.
Yeah, such a great line.
Such a great line. So Elliot, and one of the reasons I love Elliot so much. Like, we know that he had a horrific people in his life. Obviously at school, obviously teachers, as well as his own father, who is abusive. And so for him to think about it in that way, And even though he thought it, but he didn't think it could happen. It wasn't intentional. Mm-hmm. It was accidental, even if the anger and the disdain for the person was real. But yeah, he's going to feel the weight of it, and he's going to take what happened seriously instead of just explain it away that, well, I didn't mean it, and, you know. Then also, when they had the other memory of him with some of the other bullies beating up on his friend Taylor, and he said to Charlton then, hating myself for who I am is one thing, but hurting someone else mm-hmm. is, you know, to him worse. And so I think that Plover's words there could probably help Elliot a lot. Apologize for what you've done, but not who you are. You know, don't hurt anyone. But yeah, obviously Elliot grew up in this homophobic environment that he hated himself. But obviously he has absolutely nothing to apologize for. When he does do wrong things or when he does hurt people, sure, apologize for those things, but not who he is. Mm-hmm. And as well as, I think, the magician part of him. He doesn't need to apologize to people because he has magic, but he can be sorry and regret things that he does with magic that harm others, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a good parallel.
Yeah, so I was thinking about them. And then I was also thinking about a theme of trust versus fear.
Hmm.
Because, you know, oftentimes people put fear and courage as the dichotomy, right? But here, I think we have the word trust come up when Quentin and Alice are having a conversation about, okay, they completed the task, Quentin didn't die, and now she should go wherever. Hmm. You know, she said that she was going to go. And Quentin says, I loved you, but you couldn't trust that. We also get that with Elliot. I think that's how Quentin was.
Yeah.
You know, and Elliot even says to him, his memory self, that like, no, someone loved you and you just snuffed this out. And
someone pure and good.
Yeah. Okay. I'll watch Elliot. But he was loved, but he couldn't trust that, you know, and not to say that it wasn't reasonable for either of them to feel like they couldn't trust that. I mean, Alice did these monstrous, monstrous things. You know, she was this other being, and so much hurt and suffering came from it. When you can't accept those parts of yourself, believing someone else can, I can understand why that would be so difficult.
Yeah.
And you know, also why Elliot wouldn't trust that Quentin would actually want to be with him and stick with him when he has other options here on Earth. And I also think it's kind of tied together a little bit too, because Plover says that you trust one book and not another. That's funny, because she trusted the book of Quentin's life and that it was going to end in this way and she had to go stop that, but didn't trust that if she did the spell on the book, it would just send her where she was supposed to be.
Mm.
And also didn't trust that it would send Plover where he was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it makes sense, because fear was motivating her trust and her lack of trust. Fear of Quentin dying motivated her to just trust this book and do whatever needed to be done to make it so that wouldn't be the end of it. But then for the other book, because she was afraid of what Plover could do to other children, she couldn't trust that book, that it had this foolproof magic that would send him somewhere where he would do no harm, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I found it kind of interesting running through there.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
Well, why don't we go into our last major section from another point of view? Whose POV are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about Quentin's.
Yes.
So the episode opens with Quentin being told by the monster that Elliot is dead. So the majority of the episode is him grieving Elliot.
Mm-hmm.
While then having to go through a plan to try and kill the monster in Elliot's body, mm-hmm. finalizing any kind of life Elliot could have. And then he's told that he's going to die in a couple of days, that the monster will kill him in that attempt. So we see a Quentin who is, in many ways, at the end of his rope in this episode. You know, we see when Alice is there and he's trying to get her to leave, essentially, that he says that he doesn't have time for us. He doesn't have time.
For space, I think.
Space, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You know, while he's planning on killing his friend, or someone who's in his friend's body.
With his face and eyes.
Yeah. And
you're giving yourself away, Quentin.
And that's really interesting because so much of their relationship has had those positions flipped.
Absolutely. I was thinking about that too. The carriage ride to defeat Martin Chatwin, right?
Absolutely. And when she comes back from being a Niffin and mm-hmm. says, I'm dealing with so much right now, I can't deal with us too. Mm-hmm. You know, and that doesn't mean I don't love you, but it means that I can't be around you when you're looking at me, expecting me to be who I was before, and I already don't know who I am, you know? Mm-hmm. And so Alice has so often been the person who's just like, with the difficulties of our relationship, which again, most of those difficulties started with Quentin and his bad decisions. But when he tries to, you know, have the, you know, at times these big romantic gestures of trying to...
I'm going to try to win you back.
Exactly.
She's like, all I can deal with is a Sunday.
So here, he expects that that's what she's trying to do. He says, it doesn't matter what you're trying to do. I don't have space for us. And, you know, regardless of that. And she's saying, you know, I didn't come here to make up with you, but to save your life. I heard that you were dying, and I came here to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even by the end of the episode, they still are having the same kind of conversation where he's just like, I still don't have space for you in my life right now. I can't trust you. You showed that you didn't trust me. And yeah, now he's dealing with, once he's dealing with the fact that Elliot is alive mm-hmm. and he has no idea how to help him, even though Alice could very much be an asset in that, he sees her in many ways, I think, as a distraction or something that, yeah, he just doesn't have the space to emotionally deal with when he's already so overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would be practical and probably be like, no, we probably need her to help.
Right, yeah. But Quentin.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's there's a lot of small moments in this episode where I see Quentin in this extreme state for him, in a state where he has lost so much and he doesn't know what's going to happen and he faces the possibility of losing even more, that so much of his own kind of defense mechanisms come out. Right? Alice tells him that the book says he's going to die in 2 days. And his first response is, well, what if I beat the book? You know, like,
oh, Quentin.
You know, it's just like, oh, well, there's this book of my destiny. Well, now I'm just going to go against it, you know, which very much reminded me of like him giving the knife to Alice in season one and being like, I'm going to choose not to make it about myself. And we find out that
again,
he's done that a million times, you know? It's just so core to who he is, this kind of feeling like his determination is, yeah, in some ways special or, you know, able to overcome destiny or fate.
I mean, and maybe it would feel more like that when you learn about all these time loops and, mm-hmm. you know, that, well, you didn't beat him the vast majority of the time. But,
yeah,
he's both overconfident and not so.
Yeah, and, you know, I think there's an element here of Quentin having a bit of a death wish, or at least an uncaring of if he dies. You know, I think that there's a bit of Quentin here who cares more about his emotional anger and frustration with Alice and communicating that than he cares about whether she'll actually help him survive. at least in his immediate reactions. Obviously, he does ultimately say, okay, you can help me, because, you know, he's able to also logically think through the situation. But I think his emotional responses are, yeah, willing to put his own safety aside because of those larger emotional issues that he sees at least as larger.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing I found really, really fascinating in this episode was Quentin's response to the spell that tells you what you're supposed to do or where you're supposed to go. Because that sounds like the most Quentin thing I've ever heard in my life. Right? Like,
well, it does and it doesn't.
I mean, because the idea that something could tell him what he should be doing, where he should be going, you know, I think that so much of his belief in having a story and being a part of a story is about these shoulds that he puts on himself. I should be doing something, or I should be special, or I should be, you know, X, Y, or Z. And his depression makes it so that that is in conflict with what he is capable of doing, what he is going to do, the decisions he does make. Yeah, so the fact that he doesn't kind of think like, oh, I need to use the spell for myself is, I think, illustrative of, yeah, again, his deep despair and mourning of his situation, but also I think probably his belief that this is where he needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
That he doesn't need that spell right now, because his goal right now should be to help Elliot and the other friends that he cares about. And so the book doesn't have something for him. Well, I think he's more in one of those more the kind of despair spirals as it would when he's looking for the next story.
Yeah, when the thing he's doing has run its course.
Yeah.
Or it's become mundane because the big bad is dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
Then yeah, maybe that's when he would turn to the book.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, just some interesting Quentin aspects in this episode for sure. And yeah, the scene where Elliot reveals that he's still alive is just such a powerful scene. Like their performances there are both exceptional, and you can see the hurt when Quentin thinks that it's still the monster playing the game, and he says, let's not play this game, you know.
Yeah,
that is such a hard moment. And as he realizes it is Elliot. And yeah, his performance is just great. I kind of want to go back and watch it.
Yeah, it is so good. And even right before Elliot takes over, the creepy way that Monster Elliot waves is so good. I love it.
Yes.
It's very much an alien pretending to be human.
Yeah.
Oh. But yeah, such a good episode, such a good scene. I love this episode because we get so much of Elliot, both Elliot and Darth Elliot.
Mm-hmm.
And the contrast between the two is delicious.
Yes, give this person an Emmy.
I know, I want him in everything.
Well, whose perspective did you have today?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about two kind of shorter ones. One is Elliot, and we've already...
Shorter.
Yeah.
I say with quotation marks.
One is Elliot, and we've already talked about him quite a bit. But just the other moment that I'm just like, ugh, it's so good. And Hale Oppelman's performance is so good is when he's confronting himself. The memory of him and Quentin's conversation, and just you can just feel the disgust, like the self-loathing that he has when he just says, "What the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah.
What the hell are you doing?" And he's just so disappointed in himself, and he can understand so clearly what's happening and why it's happening, yet from this distant place, back when he shut that down, and for him to be going from traumatic memory to traumatic memory, and you know, disappointment, regret, all of these things, and not only going, but going with another person that he forces to come along with him. Charlton wanted to stay in the happy place, but
watch, you know, Lost.
Yeah. But allowing somebody to see this and you watching these things that you purposefully tried not to think about for so long. And then you see all of that and you know also all of these monsters that are in here and also the situation that you're in that the monster has taken over your body and the likelihood that you'll get out is quite low and all of that. So then when you go back to this memory, all of these other stakes are so much higher. And it's just like, why were you so scared of that thing? Mm. You know, in the scheme of things, would it have mattered if you tried and it didn't work? Mm. Compared to, well, maybe you'll live in this monster forever, or maybe this monster will kill all of your friends, and, you know, everything that's going on. And so, yeah, I was thinking of him. I think that he can be quite self-aware, generally, as a character. I think that he escapes that a lot through substances and partying or, you know, any of the methods that he uses. But I think a lot of that is to escape because he's not oblivious to it. And that's why he wants the distraction. And he even said something like that, I think, to Charlton about self-awareness and happiness, like, don't always go hand in hand sort of thing. And the main way that he's been able to find some happiness is by ignoring those other things. So, yeah, I think that that moment that he just looks at his, not that long ago, but, you know, still a while ago self, and is just so disappointed in it and so frustrated with himself. Yeah, I think it's just such a good scene, and I was just really feeling for him in a moment that he's confronted with so many moments in his life that have been so difficult and so many moments that have contributed to him not self-loathing himself anymore because of his sexual identity, but because of choices that he's made that he regrets.
Yeah, another really powerful scene, and I can't believe I haven't said this yet this episode, but, like, just this entire episode is just another example why fantasy and magical storytelling can be so amazing, because it allows for these kinds of character moments. It allows a character to literally confront themselves and say the things that they wish they could say in that moment. And even though that doesn't change that moment, we see so much of that character. We see so much more depth, and it allows for these really interesting new ways to tell stories and show character growth and all these things that, as much as obviously, you know, fiction without magical qualities can also do amazing things with that, but there is something really special about the kinds of situations that magic or science fiction or these other kinds of genres can bring out, because we accept rules outside the rules of our reality.
Definitely. And then the other person I'm thinking about is Margot.
Oh, Margot.
She has such a great line when Fenn is asking her if she's even cried about Elliot. Margot says, "I can't cry out all the sadness, because if I start, I'll never stop and I'll be useless forever," which is just, oh, so good.
Yes.
And
seeing her almost breaking down there, like seeing, even talking about that, move her towards being overwhelmed emotionally is, yeah, just amazing.
Yeah, it's so good. And then I relate to her, not necessarily about death in the same way, though I haven't had anybody that close like Elliot is to her in my life die. But what I really relate to is, I think, growing up in the abusive situations I grew up in, I did learn from a pretty young age to shut my emotions down, and got to the point where I rarely cried. You know, I cry more easily now than I used to, but it was like a process to be able to get to the point where I could cry. And even to this day, sometimes, like, if I feel like sad or like I feel like I need to feel the emotions more, there's this one song that I'll put on. Not that it'll make me cry, but it's like an emotional outlet. Just the emotion in that song, like somebody else's emotion and being able to hear it, for some reason helps me access a little bit of my own sadness in a way that can feel like a relief. Like I remember after my aunt died, Hugh, most people in the family had a kind of strained or difficult relationship with her. And that wasn't not the case with me, but also she had lived with us for a few years when I was growing up. And, you know, of the aunts, we had spent the most time with her and stuff. And I remember putting on that song one time because I'm like, I feel sad about this, but I'm not like crying about it and I need something, you know? And so I was feeling a lot for Margot here because there's all of these other people around her crying and sad and mourning about it. But for her, like, this is the closest person in her life, but she can't. She just can't let herself because she's so worried that if she does, she just won't be able to function anymore at all.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's definitely some things that I've dealt with. Sometimes you do need to protect yourself for a while because you're not supported enough to be able to process something at a particular time. And you have to like maybe get to a slightly better place and then open the floodgates or whatnot. And so, yeah, I just feel so sad for her because she has to just concentrate on the next thing and the next thing to solve. And when she can't and there's a barrier that comes in, then she's gonna pop an Ambien and she can't even escape through other ways. She has to escape from consciousness because if her mind isn't working to solve someone else's problem, it's going to drift back to Elliot and she can't deal with it.
Yeah.
Even if she should try.
Yeah, although we also see her, you know, they kind of use it as a punchline, but we see her say that she's been with Fen crying for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is also a really fantastic Margot moment, because Margot, at the beginning of the series, would not have sat with Fen for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that she's doing so, I think, shows how she has grown more compassionate and how she also recognizes all Fen has done for them and how Fen has become a member of their family, found family, what have you, through, yeah, being the acting High King, through everything with their baby and the fairy deals, you know, like Margot and Fen. I don't think Margot finds Fen, you know, the person that she loves the most, her personality, but I think that she has a lot of care for Fen, and her spending that time with her as she mourns, I think, is a real testament to all the ways that Margot has expanded her belief in her own responsibilities, you know, to not just be that she's the High King and she has responsibilities to get things done, which is also Margot, but also that there's responsibilities to the people around her, which is just like, Margot, you're the best.
She isn't the
best.
She's
not the best. But she's great.
She's definitely one of the best characters in this show.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we revisit the title of this episode, Escape from the Happy Place? What do you think?
It's a great title.
I love it.
Yeah. It lets us know about the happy place. It's the kind of thing that you wouldn't normally see in a title, right? Because why are you escaping a happy place? It's very Magicians.
Yeah.
You know, title the place that's not where you want to be, a happy place. You know, it's great.
Yeah, love it.
Okay, well, that will wrap up our discussion on this episode. So what's happening next time on The Magicians?
So we're going to be on episode 6, A Timeline and a Place, where we get not one, but two pennies.
Can't wait to hear your 2 cents on that episode.
Oh!
Well, thank you all so much for listening to this week's episode of Geek Between the Lines. You can find links to our website, our social media, and our Patreon in the episode description. And we hope that you'll join us on Patreon so you can come to our monthly meetups.
Yeah!
We want to thank Kimberly Kuniko at Lacelet for designing our logo. You can find her designs at lacelet.com, Instagram, or Substack. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week. Until then, geek out!